Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
And we shall wonder if one day our game is played on the other planets. We will have interplanetary competition.
Your job now is to stand by our new manager.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
If my granny had balls, he'd be my granddad.
Big Sam Aladicio, that's on it.
So myself and the Irish Independent's Dan McDonald are here. There's much to discuss this evening. We'll talk about Celtic later on in the show, who are through to the Champions League stages. They lost 4-3 in Astana this evening. Obviously, they were 5-0 up. Things were shaky for a while, but
yeah,
they got it done in the end.
Amazing that it ended up being shaky for a while from being 5-0 up from the first leg, considering they scraped past Astana last year. At this stage of the competition, 5-0 looks pretty emphatic yet. They show they still have some vulnerabilities there.
We'll also talk to Nick Harris from Sporting Intelligence about the Fancy Bears leak in relation to TUEs at the 2010 World Cup and also the 150 failed tests across 2015. Many of them recreational drugs, many of them in Mexico as well. Nick Harris has all the details on that. So that's coming up very shortly. A few other bits to get through first. The fallout from Everton, Manchester City. One, Patrick Davison from Sky Sports tweeted last night, thanks for all the messages of support, because it was Patrick Davison's job to interview Pep Guardiola at full time for Sky Sports. Based on last season, that generally wasn't so bad a prospect until about midway through the season when it was clear that Manchester City's season was in free fall. Whereas Pep's come out of the blocks hot this season. Extra tetchy, extra difficult to interview, extra difficult.
The rageometer is
non-stop.
Fire there.
The face scratching, the attitude.
It's tough.
Frankly,
it is tough. The Sky lads get a bit of grief sometimes, but that can be a tough, that's a tough brief sometimes.
He was agitated all evening. There was, the cameras picked it up on the Sky cameras picked it up at half time when he was coming back out for the second half when Kyle Walker had just been sent off and Michael Oliver was the fourth official. And if people didn't see it, there were moments in the first half, not least when Kyle Walker was sent off, he got a second yellow, and it wasn't a yellow card, but Michael Oliver was being confronted by several Manchester City players and Pep, and several times you could just read Oliver listening to Vincent Kompany and occasionally turning to Pep and just saying, Pep, because Pep was shouting in his face. It'd say, Pep, back off. And then Oliver would take a few steps further away and would keep talking to Vincent Kompany. Guardiola would follow them, interrupt the conversation again. Michael Oliver, Pep.
Yeah.
And then at halftime, Pep saw him and Pep was pointing, clearly knowing the cameras were on him. And I mean, the man's no fool. He understands.
He knows the game. Under
scrutiny. He was pointing back to inside the dressing room and to his eyes as if to say, I've seen it on television. And he started mimicking Kyle Walker's actions a little more gracefully than Walker had done. I mean, it definitely wasn't a yellow, but Pep just kind of half nudged into Oliver several times. I mean, if Dermot Connolly had done this, Dan, there would be outrage. He did make contact with Michael Oliver here, but he was agitated all evening, Pep, with good reason.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly in terms of the red card incident, which wasn't a red card. Although we lose the moral high ground a small bit when Schneiderlin gets sent off sort of unfairly later on as well.
Yeah.
When Aguero definitely makes a meal of that too. And, you know, that's just evening it up. But yeah, he has, like, he does have this sort of, it's just sort of anger lingering beneath. There's still that, you still sense that there's that pressure there that this isn't going as smoothly as it should be. Mm. Even though, I mean, their performance last night was pretty good in the circumstances. You know,
in the second half, down to 10 men, they bossed
really
the game.
Really good. And yeah, you could argue Everton were very well organised in the first half and very solid display, but probably against 10, they weren't good enough really to expose them, because City not overpowered them, but just outplayed them in terms of their application. And I mean, sometimes Everton in that situation, they didn't necessarily, even later on in the game, they brought Besic on and they didn't necessarily have the tools to really be like rapid fire on the counter. They had Rooney. No. They didn't have the players to expose the situation. They would have loved to have Lukaku, you know, for that scenario that they found themselves in.
They had Dominic Calvert-Lewin, born in 1997, who very well for large chunks of the game, to the point where, and Gary Neville was citing this as just not good, just not ideal, that they had to switch Otamendi and Vincent Kompany, it's usually Kompany who plays on the right of Stones. So they made that switch. So again, Neville was saying in some ways it's not massive, but in others, just not good, just not ideal. It just points to the fact that not everything is right. And for the Rooney goal, he couldn't believe the way Vincent Kompany stepped up. Vincent Kompany was marking a man and there was an Everton player running towards the two of them. And Neville said, like, Kompany's only job here is to stay with his man. Don't leave your man and step up to meet the midfielder with the ball, because there were other people there. And he just couldn't, he was at a loss as to explain why Kompany, so experienced, stepped up and, to quote Neville, speeded up the attack for Everton. But once he stepped up, ball slipped down the wing and they're in and it's played across to Rooney. So something's still not quite right there when somebody like Kompany is making those
mistakes. I mean, do you give Kompany a, there's the broader debate about, I mean, is that based on instruction or just a bad mistake?
Yeah.
But I mean, do you give Kompany a bit of leeway just given the, you know, they desperately want Kompany to work and they desperately want him to stay and be part of the club.
Yeah.
But he's had such an interrupted phase in his career that, okay, you want him there because there's maybe not a huge amount of alternatives out there that are better, yet he's a diminished force, perhaps, relative to where he was.
Yeah.
And that's a difficult one to manage. And we've seen him with, I mean, age was still a big problem with that Man City side last year, and that's something they wanted to address. And even by bringing in you know, Walker and Mendy and place, you know, trying to sharpen up the defence where they were so old last year, but they still have those mistakes in them. But I don't know. I mean, Pep's just agitated state afterwards. I mean, it was primarily based on a refereeing decision, it would appear. I mean, that was the anger. What was the line that, you know, go on to the next question because he wanted to be involved?
Well, in exciting news, we've just grabbed the audio.
Oh, here's it. We're building up to that moment.
On, Sky Sports. We've probably built it up too much now.
Almost too much.
What's the big deal? It was fine. But it was Pep speaking with Sky Sports' Patrick Davison.
Did you pay in the first half for not being ruthless enough when you were on top?
Yeah, we created the chances, but important is created, so we didn't finish it, but okay. We have to try to create the chances.
What did you make of their goal? Where were the mistakes?
About?
Their goal, from a City point of view, what went wrong? Why did it happen?
Which goal?
Their goal, the Everton goal.
Ah, no, they made a good action.
Okay. Anything more your players could have done?
We have done everything. So I don't know how many chances we create. I don't know how many chances they create. And with 10-11, 65, 70 minutes. So it's nothing to do. It was quite similar to Burnley last year when we were together, when after Liverpool, 2 days after, and after 35 minutes, we play again 70 minutes with 10 men. In that moment, we were able to win the game. And today was just a draw.
What did you make of Kyle Walker's red card?
Next question, please.
You don't want to get drawn into it?
Of course not. I want to be in Bournemouth.
Just tell us then about, tactically, how you changed it at half-time, having gone down to 10 men. What did you do?
No, in the half-time, we changed everything. During the second half, we made some... But tactic is the quality of the players. We put more players in the middle to more control, and we create enough chances.
How pleased were you with Raheem Sterling that, I mean, he's been on the bench, that when he came on he took his chance?
A lot, with all of them. I'm pleased with all of them.
How important was it that you didn't lose tonight?
Well, we lost 2 points.
So you're disappointed overall?
No, we lost 2 points.
Okay, you didn't lose the game though?
Yeah, that's good. After what happened, we went down, so make a draw on how we tried. So here, of course, the results, we are here for the results, but at the end, we have to try to analyze the performance. So, and it's one of the most proud days in my life, seeing how we have done, the way we have done. So 10-11 against Everton, Europa League team, top quality of the players, and with 10-11, 65, 70 minutes notice, and we tried. So after we missed at the end some chances, even with 11 we did then, and we didn't score goals, and that's why we could not win.
Thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
Mm.
Tough beat, though.
Tough, yeah.
You got two, I don't know how long that was, but
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Felt like eight.
A lot of questions in 2 minutes.
You know? Sometimes he can answer for 2 or 3 minutes. Other times he might give you 2 words.
Yeah, that was like a quick fire, an awkward sort of, I don't know, like Irish oral exam or something. Just quick fire questions, short answers, and just keep going. You know?
The quickest way to make life difficult for an interviewer is just very short answers.
Oh yeah,
you run out of steam very quickly.
It's just like it's just knocking the serve back over the net, and it's like, right, what do you do? You know, what do you do in any entry? I mean, particularly for the live, because you just know that every viewer or listener is like, he's doing all the wrong things there. You can get away with it in a sort of a newspaper setting, a small bit, but still that sort of torturous phase.
There's no doubt being an interviewer on newspaper is much easier.
Oh yes, of course,
much easier,
much easier gig, and so you carry it well, Joe.
That's Pep. After pre-match, he had told, and he was a bit nicer to Davison pre-match, but he was saying, you know, the big thing this year is that last year our away form was excellent. We were in the top two or three in the league. It was our home form that killed us. So that was probably part of his anger last night, that here we are at home again. We just made a mess of things again.
Yeah. He was speaking in the local papers. I was reading the stuff today, and you know, teams taking their one chance and killing them was his argument. So he wasn't buying into Pat's argument there about what was wrong with the goal. His argument is all the chances that we've missed is the problem, not that goal.
Yeah. Latest in the Championship, there's lots of games on this evening. Ipswich Town have just pulled a goal back against Crystal Palace in the 92nd minute, but they are trailing 2-1. So that's Mick McCarthy and Ipswich's 100% record in jeopardy.
But it's the EFL Cup, so they're heading out. They're heading out the EFL Cup.
Do I have to give all these results then?
You can run. They're selected. I mean, there's selected ones. I wouldn't go through them all.
25 games.
There's a sort of a truckload of Irish stories of some note. I mean, Scott Hogan has scored twice for Aston Villa.
Aston Villa 4, Wigan 1.
That's, and there's also a bloke from Carlow, Jake Doyle Hayes, has met his debut for Villa as well.
Okay.
So Cavan, Bally James Duff, my God. So we have the Cavan presence in senior football being beefed up.
Brighton 1, Barnet 0.
Yeah, Richie Towell and Jason Malumbi involved in that game. Again, Malumbi, a young guy from Ireland, and Towell, who wasn't even given a squad number, but he is playing in the Cup, trying to get a loan moved. There's a few options for him to the Championship, League 1. So probably trying to put himself in the shop window tonight. In terms of Mick McCarthy now in Ipswich, there's no real shame in that, because they made 11 changes from the weekend. They've played a bunch of kids tonight against a relatively strong Palace side, and they've pretty much turned the corner, Ipswich, from what was a difficult season last year to be in a position where they've a 100% record in the league, and they're resting players because actually now their league season has gained a bit of momentum. So that was a free pass tonight, and they've sort of done okay in the circumstances.
We'll continue with Mick for a second. Owen is wondering, what was Pep meant to do with those questions? He was fishing for a cheap headline. Pep was overly polite to him. I'm not quite sure. I think some of the questions were very valid, like, what more could your team have done about the goal conceded, when there were very clear things Man City could have done? And when his answer is nothing, we did everything, that's just a bit disingenuous and slightly rude, to be honest.
Yeah, look, I understand people will always be on the side primarily of the person receiving the questions, because unfair, but that is a part of their job. They are the questions that you are sent to ask. What went wrong with the goal? It's not an unreasonable question.
It's not.
There wasn't stuff there, you know, poking away for a headline along the lines of, oh, there's speculation around this player or that player, what's going on. It was actually pretty much match-based questioning.
They were all match-based,
which is sometimes the criticism when it goes beyond that. I mean, that was pretty much, tell us what happened in the game. You're the manager. Please explain to us what happened. Wasn't unfair. And that's not just people sticking by the... Sometimes the questions can be daft, but those ones weren't.
No. So Mick McCarthy and Neil Warnock, both 100% records in the Championship thus far. And Mick was talking at the weekend. He was talking about meeting Neil Warnock. They've known each other since the 70s. They met at Barnsley. He was the biggest 16-year-old ever, said Mick, of Neil Warnock. But also a great guy, a tough nut. I think he was shaving at 12. And then after the win, he was quizzed about how well both he and Warnock have started the campaign. And Mick was saying, two old farts who know F all about the game, hey? I'll have to get out my iPad now. And
loves it.
Yeah, he's obviously had a lot of criticism at Ipswich.
Stack loads.
He got a standing ovation after this most recent game because they're going so well. Mick, that must be nice, given the criticism and everything else. Mick said, I treat it, the ovation, with the same contempt as the booze. So this is a brave thing to say. I mean, this is an olive branch from the fans. He can easily say, it's great, you know, it's great to have their support, blah, blah, blah. He said, I treat it with the same contempt as the booze. It shows how fickle football is.
Yeah.
Really honest stuff from McCarthy. But he's at that point in his career now where he really doesn't care about telling the truth about anything.
True, but I think Mick has always operated throughout his career from the perspective that he's been written off and that this is, so he's I'm sure deep down he probably still would have been happy with that, you know, but probably from the sense of that showed those, you know, those feckers who were all over me last year. And, you know, he could have walked away easily. And that's the one thing you have to respect about him. He could have walked away easily. What more did he have to gain from another season there other than just the bug and having the bug for the game? Because he's the longest serving manager in that division by some distance. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not a big budget club, so it's going to be very hard for him to challenge. So really, he's trying to deal with almost unrealistic expectations. He could walk away from it, but he still loves that game, and it keeps him going, and he keeps coming back for more. He's getting off the ropes almost most of his career, it seems, and he keeps bouncing back.
Myself and Kev went out to Carton House to interview him ahead of pre-season. That's where he brings Ipswich over the last number of years. And I must say, I'd never met him before. We spent a good 10-15 minutes chatting beforehand, and he gave us an hour of his time. I liked him as much as anybody I ever had the privilege to meet in this job. He's a class act. Yeah. Genuine, not over the top, not schmoozy, just genuine fella. Bit of crack. Clearly very intelligent as well, and just really, really liked him. Made a good impression. I can see why players love him. Really see it.
He's managed for 25 years, pretty much unbroken. Like, you know, that's a huge feat when you talk to the amount of percentage of people, managers, who don't even get a second job.
Yeah.
He's been in management for 25 years, but not too many breaks.
And that is why he had the old, I better check my iPad now. You know, me and Warnock are dinosaurs, aren't we? And this came up. I'll play a clip of this interview. It's worth digging at the whole thing because I think he was really good on a range of subjects, not least dealing with the criticism he's had at Ipswich over the last number of years. But on that notion that he's an old codger and him and Warnock are in the Stone Age and I better get my iPad now, he cracks in the press conference. So I put it to him, you know, as a player and then as a manager, he's basically been in the game for, God, mid-80s, more early 80s, long time as a player, then manager, straight into management, still relevant, will get a job in the morning if he is ever sacked in the morning. He'll get one by lunchtime. And so I asked him, genuine question here, to what extent has the game changed in terms of tactics? So as a player and as a manager since 1992 at Millwall, in terms of the tactics, in terms of the way you'll set up a team, in terms of the things you're seeing from a Pep Guardiola or Jurgen Klopp or any of these teams, to what extent has the game changed?
The game hasn't changed at all. There's certain things have been changed, of course, because the back pass to the goalkeeper, the fact offside rule continues to change. They keep trying to tinker with it slightly. They're now looking at action replays to see if they can get decisions correct. And I hear them on television, four of them, and still can't get a decision right. I still disagree with them when I've seen them say it one way and I think it's another. It hasn't changed. I mean, the words have changed. Mm. What do you say? Transition. Yeah, you know. Catching them on the back, winning the ball back and going the other way. Velocity of dispersal, somebody threw at me once. That's how quickly they break on somebody. I went, hey? I asked one youth physio, I said, are you the physio? He said, no, I'm the head of medical medicine tech. Oh, and I said to him, how wide do you do? Can you just put physiotherapist on it like everybody else used to do? He had this huge, long... Yeah. So that's changed, and I do hear people talk about it. Well, I hear him now talking about Liverpool and Jurgen Klopp, and I think he's brilliant, by the way. I love him. I think he's a breath of fresh air. But whatever they call it, this, you know, gegenpress, what was Jack Charlton saying in 1988? Put him under pressure. We used to squeeze the life out of teams. We did it. And they hated playing against us.
Yeah, it's unbelievable how the pressing thing has been talked about like a new thing in the last five years.
Yeah, because people stopped doing it and stopped getting people in behind and sitting in their half. Mm. And it became boring hell. Well, pressing and winning the ball back further up the pitch. So it evolves. It just keeps changing. But then people come in and think they've changed the world. And they haven't.
Yes.
But, you know, if you've got really good players, you can go and press. If you've got really good players, you can fan out and play the game.
Mm.
So my chairman said, summed it for me at Millwall, Mr. Burr, when asked about his sheepskin gloves and sheepskin coat, the journalist said, is it a superstition? Is it superstitious? He said, yeah, of course it is. He said, does it work? He said, it tends to work better with a good team than it does with a bad team.
Yeah.
And that really sums football up for me.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I've seen managers with a real good team mess it up, and I've seen managers and coaches with a team who people thought would never work.
Mm.
David Wagner, for instance, at Huddersfield, got them promoted. They were brilliant last year. Mm. They were fab.
So I suspect you, along with maybe Souness and some others, are rolling your eyes a little bit at some of the ways the game is discussed, and you haven't changed your approach massively in 20 years of management.
No, right. No. And of course, you know, I read the quote, forgot it was from, if you keep doing the same thing and it don't work, then it's completely crazy. But it's been working pretty well. And of course, when I've had good teams, I had a good team at Wolves, I had a good team at Sunderland, we won the league.
Yeah.
I had a good team with Ireland, and we ended up getting to the last 16 of the World Cup, doing the same things. I was asked here yesterday, will you be doing periodisation? I think he knew by the blank look on my face. I wasn't quite sure. He said, you know, will you be doing the rotation policy? And also, I don't know. The terminology's changed, and I do think I listen to the people in the academy, and I get lost at times listening to them. I'm not out of date. I'm not an old fogey. I've stayed with the modern trends, and when I think the modern trends are good, modern stuff's good, the technology, the nutrition, the strength and conditioning. If there's any tactical that we can use, I'll use it.
Mm.
But the football is still about keeping it. However you want to do that, whatever system you play, put it in that other net. And when you haven't got it, is getting it back. Whether you want to get it back quick up the pitch after five passes, or you want to sit back and soak it up and catch them on the break, do whatever you want to do.
Mm.
But football hasn't changed.
There's Mick there. The full interview is worth the listen. He was just really good on everything. He's just endlessly kind of interesting, thoughtful.
Yeah, and I mean, there is huge logic in what he says, particularly at the level he's in. You look at the same type of managers are succeeding in the Championship as well, because I think managing at that level, it's about managing personalities. Players have come down a level, guys on the way up. But I think it's basically man management and stuff. I think particularly in that 46-game season, you know, where it's just about keeping the show on the road, I can understand completely. I know he was talking broadly, but I also think his longevity comes down to his understanding very much of that level and the characters that sort of populate it. And it's no surprise that him and other managers, Warnock and others, they are the promotion kings or the masters of that level, because their approach works. Now, why would they change something that's worked for them?
We'll be talking to Nick Harris next from Sporting Intelligence. Fancy Bears have been wowing us with their leaks in sport over the last year or two, and they've turned their attention to football for the first time.
Off the ball, thanks to Air. Watch all of Ireland's matches in the Women's Rugby World Cup live on Air Sport during August.
Hey, you're welcome back. So, Fancy Bears have been hacking various sporting organisations' databases and providing us with leaks on a range of sports over the last couple of years, not least athletics, and they've turned their attention to football for the first time. On their website today, greetings, citizens of the world. You can have a look at WADA documents revealing that more than 150 football players were caught doping in 2015. The next year, this number increased to up to 200 athletes. Today, Fancy Bears' hack team is publishing the material leaked from various sources related to football. Football players and officials unanimously affirm that this kind of sport is free of doping. Our team perceived these numerous claims as a challenge and now will prove that they are lying. Nick Harris from Sporting Intelligence has had a look at the Fancy Bears leaks. And there's two aspects to this, Nick. There's the 150 players caught doping in 2015, which we can come on to. And then the aspect which has caught more of the headlines, it's about the TUEs, the therapeutic use exemptions at the World Cup in 2010 in South Africa. 25 players, including some big names, were listed off as having TUEs at that World Cup. You might start by fleshing out what the report, what the Fancy Bears report is saying about the 2010 World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, I think to start off, we have to say that their claim is sort of rather pompous. This idea that anyone in their right mind thinks there isn't doping in football is a nonsense claim. We all know there's doping in all sports in all countries. And the actual substance of what they've leaked is, I would contend, pretty underwhelming. I mean, arguably the most interesting and certainly the only genuinely original stuff is the names of players who received therapeutic exemptions. That means, obviously, as your listeners will know, a permission to use banned drugs for medical purposes. So some of the names there: Carlos Tevez of Argentina, Dirk Kuyt of the Netherlands, Gabriel Heinze of Argentina are amongst those names. The substances they were given permission to use, certainly in the case of four Argentinians, and they also included Wan Veron, was a corticosteroid, we think probably a cream, it's called a betamethasone. It's a corticosteroid, and it's often used for a range of conditions, including acne and difficulty with breathing, all sorts of different things. It is banned on the World Anti-Doping Agency list, but it depends. It's like many drugs. It's used in certain circumstances or at different prescriptions. It's not actually illegal. So that was the substance that they were given permission to use. Again, we don't know what details, but you know, it was declared and known about, and hence no rules were broken, that Coit had an ear infection, I think it was a tooth problem.
Yeah,
tooth problem, using dexamethasone. And then salbutamol, which comes up in a lot of these cases, which is commonly used in asthma inhalers, was used by, amongst others, the German international Mario Gomez. So that was arguably the most revelatory thing. Big name pro players have been given permission to use substances that in circumstances are banned and are on the WADA list. I think the wider issues, the wider sort of leak, this sort of rather grandiose claim that football will be rocked to its socks is, I think, disingenuous at best. I mean, you know, I've got to stress, I'm not somebody who thinks there is no drugs in football. I think it's probably a lot more drugs in football than the general population believes.
Yeah.
There is obviously and has been a serious drug problem in football, in Italy and other countries, there will be in Britain, whatever. But when you actually go down to the detail of looking through these lists, there's a big spreadsheet they've released from 215. Most, if not all, of the detail of it, the nitty-gritty of it, it's in the public domain already. I mean, if you want me to actually go through, and you don't need to get your lawyers to cut me off when I start naming names, because these are public domain cases.
Yeah, and just to keep the listeners with us, so this is us leaving the 2010 World Cup stuff for the time being.
Sorry.
This is going on to this wider claim. 150 players were caught doping in 2015. And I think where I sense you're going with this is four of those cases were UK cases and...
Nine of them.
Okay, sorry. Yeah. But a number of them are already in the public domain. And, you know, again, 150 players across 2015. Two of these cases involve players from North Ferriby, a semi-professional club in the National League North. And I'm not overly familiar with the National League North, I have to tell you.
Yeah, no, North Ferriby was actually a later case. That there's different tracks of information. There was a spreadsheet from 2015, there's the two series from 2010, and then a load of random documents. The North Ferriby cases were actually 2017, I believe, 2016, 2017.
Yeah.
And again, these are two players alleged to have used performance-enhancing drugs in the non-league in England, and also a Middlesbrough player who was used the same drug that has got Bradley Wiggins involved in all kinds of allegations, which again, under certain circumstances, perfectly legal. And that's he was actually found to have used it perfectly legal with permission. The headline grabbing, you know, 150 cases around the world from 2015, there was nine came under UCAS, UK sports. So we talk about nine, primarily pretty much all in English football. But let me just explain it. You know, we know, and this is a massive public record, I've gone through the nine cases, I've cross-referenced the dates, the substances and whatever, and I can tell you the names with no controversy. But one of those nine, for example, was a Hull footballer, Jake Livermore, who tested positive for cocaine, which is a massive public record. Mm. Another one was a Sheffield United player called Jose Baxter. Again, it's a massive public record. He tested positive for ecstasy. The dates match, the case match, it's public domain. Another case was a Wolves player that same summer called Aaron McCarry. And two of these nine cases were salbutamol cases. One of them's an Irish international, Alan Judge. Again, it's a case. It's in the public domain. He was playing for Brentford at the time, and he failed a drugs test for salbutamol. The case went before UCAD. The ruling is in the public domain. The reporting is in the public domain at the time. He was actually given a warning because his salbutamol level was slightly above the allowed level, but it wasn't even deemed harsh enough for him to be banned for 3 months, let alone 2 years. Again, it's a public domain case. Mm. So of the nine British cases, UCAD cases, the case that basically relating to English football involving British and Irish footballers, you know, we know about them. They are 7 recreational drug cases and 2 salbutamol cases and no performance-enhancing drug cases in those 9 cases.
Yeah.
And again, I want to stress, I'm not playing down or mitigating or saying that football doesn't have a drug problem. It clearly does in some areas. But the idea that this is new or that it's shocking or that we didn't know about it or it's revelatory is, I'm afraid, just not true. Mm. You know, again, in those 150, arguably, the most interesting thing in those 150 cases is there's 27 unnamed Mexican footballers who tested positive for the anabolic steroid clenbuterol, which suggests that, you know, maybe Mexican football's got a major steroid problem. An alternative explanation is you know, there is some evidence that actually, you know, Mexico is one country where eating contaminated steak has actually been proved in some instances to be a legitimate reason why people are testing positive for steroids. So either there's a lot of bad steak or a serious drug problem in Mexico. But,
yeah,
you know, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But the one other thing I would make in general is the Fancy Bears, who, of course, have given us lots of great copy and good stories to go on over the last few years, and fair play to them for that. They are Russian. And what's conspicuous by its absence from this league is anything to do with the 34 Russian football drug cases that we know were picked up by the McLaren report and are currently sitting on a desk gathering dust in a FIFA office somewhere. Yeah. You know,
to remind people, the entire 2014 Russian squad is under investigation technically.
The 23 members of the 2014 squad are amongst those 34 plus cases being looked at by FIFA. You know, and I'd be fascinated to know, you know, if they've got leaks about what isn't or isn't happening with those cases. So I think we've got a mixed bag of sort of revelations here.
Yeah, there is no doubt with Fancy Bears, as good as a lot of the information is, you do have to very much put it in context. The Fancy Bears website is certainly out to, I guess, shoot down the hypocrisy that Russia's bad, everybody else is clean as a whistle. And so that is their prerogative in certain respects here. Where it is useful, in a sense, regarding the 2010 World Cup, is not so much that I think Tevez or Varane or Gabriel Heinze or Dirk Kuyt with his sore tooth have major questions to answer. It's useful for two reasons. One, it shows that there is, of course, a TUE culture in football, which I don't think will surprise any reasonably smart listener. And secondly, that certain countries are not partaking in the culture. Argentina has 5 players on the list. Germany has 4. You know, so you take the corticosteroid that you mentioned, betamethasone, which is an anti-inflammatory. I would certainly presume a number of English players had problems with their muscles, you know, games in quick succession, the end of a long season. It's quite interesting to see that, for instance, there are no TUEs in the English team, and Argentina, by comparison, have 5. So one wonders, is there some ethical or moral abstination going on here on the part of England, or is it just a quirk that they didn't need them on this occasion? And, you know, I wonder if we look at various other World Cups or tournaments, will we see that Argentina routinely topped the list? You know, those kind of questions are interesting, but we don't quite have all the answers to those kind of questions.
Absolutely, they are interesting. I think that there would be no reason whatsoever to suggest England is any less guilty or less prone to using TUEs. You know, I would certainly never make that claim that English, the English FA, are sort of more sort of reluctant to be involved. I just think there's no evidence.
I wouldn't think so either. I use that example purely because they have 0 in this tournament, and I just presume that's some kind of statistical quirk more so than an ethical one.
Yeah, and it might well be that some nations, I mean, you know, again, I don't want to be, you know, say anything that could possibly sound like, you know, generalizations about particular cultures or nations or whatever, but there certainly will be some sporting cultures where, you know, perhaps using particular types of medication simply is just not an issue, and you know, and if it's allowed and it is legal, which it is under the rules and the rest of it, then there isn't, you know, there is no problem with it, technically speaking.
Yeah.
But yeah, it certainly raises interesting questions. I mean, for me, the TUE debate, you know, can be massively simplified simply by, as a matter of course, the argument is always for athletes with TUEs that I've got nothing to hide. Mm. Well, I would say in the vast majority of cases, then, if you've got nothing to hide, should it not be sort of the default position that sports people declare when they've got a TUE, given that it's supposedly for such innocuous reasons as acne or an ear infection or, you know, a poorly toe or, you know, some muscle ache, You know, of course, there will be people, there might be people with fertility problems or erectile dysfunction or some kind of, you know, fertility, some very genuine and private medical condition that they wouldn't want to declare. And I would say that's absolutely fine. You know, nobody's got the right to know about anyone else's private medical history. But I think in the vast majority of cases where the argument is, you know, I'm taking a TUE for innocuous reason, why don't we move towards a culture whereby, as a matter of course, TUEs are publicly declared then, have a public TUE register. And that would get rid of a lot of these questions. You've got nothing to hide. Declare it.
Yeah. Nick Harris, thanks for that from Sporting Intelligence. Appreciate it.
Okay. Cheers.
Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to AIR. Watch 42 live Premier League games this season on the AIR Sport Pack.
Welcome back. Myself and Dan still here. So we're talking Celtic now. They're into the group stages of the Champions League. 4-3 on the night. They lost to Astana. So Celtic won 8-4 on aggregate. The rather bizarre scoreline. David Friel of the Scottish Sun is on the line. Also the author of Invincible, Brendan Rodgers' historic first season at Celtic. David, thanks for joining us. So 4-3 to Astana this evening. 8-4 to Celtic on aggregate. It's hard to know what went on here.
Yeah, defence is on top, I think, you know. It was probably one of the most bizarre two-legged contests I've seen in my time. You know, Celtic were really good in the first leg, winning 5-0, and then tonight was just crazy. I mean, Scott Brown, Celtic's captain, described it as a game of basketball, and that's probably the best way to sum it up. I mean, at one point, I did think Celtic were in a bit of trouble, amazingly, given they were 5-0 going into the game, but they managed to get the job done.
Yeah, in broader terms, there's a huge amount of positivity around Celtic at the moment. So they're back again in the Champions League. Their squad is as strong, if not stronger, than it's been in a long time. Many people saying, you know, you could argue right back to even Martin O'Neill's time. Last season was the invincible season, as your book alludes to, 47 games unbeaten domestically. Only Jock Stein and Martin O'Neill had done that for Celtic previously. Is there a sense that they're going to hang on to more than their players? Like, you look at 2013 when the likes of Fraser Foster and Van Dijk and Wanyama and Hooper all left the club. Is there a sense that Celtic have a bit more stability about them going forward now under Rodgers?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I do think players will leave. I mean, I think it's natural at a club like Celtic, where they can't probably pay the wages you definitely get in England, that players will leave. And I think there will be, over the next week or so, there'll be a lot of speculation about guys like Moussa Dembele, Jozo Simunovic, guys like that. But I think the good thing for Celtic is that, given that they've now got the money, which is estimated to be about £30 million from the Champions League, they don't need to sell. You know, there's no gun being held to their head to say you have to take £20 million for Dembele or anything like that. So I think Brendan Rodgers will be very relaxed. He's about to sign Patrick Roberts again on loan from Manchester City, and he's probably in the market for another defender and another striker. So I think Celtic will be stronger come the end of the window. That's not necessarily to say players might not leave, but I don't think you'll see a team breaking up very, very soon, you know.
Dave, I mean, what do you make of that comparison that Joe mentioned there? I mean, you've been covering the Scottish beat for quite a while. I mean, where does this Celtic team stand compared to the, you know, the teams at the start of this century that were, you know, progressing to the knockout stages of European tournaments?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's, you know, I think Martin O'Neill's team had such, you know, it was so expensively assembled, and it had such good players like Henrik Larsson, Chris Sutton, John Hartson, Stylian Petrov. And if you're saying to me, would those guys get in this current team? Of course they would. Would Victor Wanyama get in? Would, you know, Joe Ledley at his peak? Probably. You know, Gary Hooper, I'm not so sure. But, you know, if you compare it to Martin O'Neill's team, I think Martin O'Neill had a better team, but Celtic were paying big money back then. But I think what this team is, as opposed to the individuals, there's a real team unit, and I think that's where Brendan Rodgers has been so successful, in the sense that he's a good coach. He's managed to get the best out of players who, pretty much, Dan, to be honest with you, had been, you know, consigned to a dustbin. Celtic fans didn't really care if they kept guys like Michael Lustig and Tom Rogic and Callum McGregor. And what Brendan Rodgers has done is basically, you know, these players are reborn now. And I mean, if you look at the team tonight, only two players that he signed started tonight. The rest he inherited or were kids coming through. So that shows what a job he's done. You know, no Celtic manager, including Martin O'Neill, Gordon Strachan, and Neil Lennon, qualified at the first attempt for the Champions League. Brendan Rodgers has now done it 2 years in a row. And it's worth fortunes to Celtic. And he's also taking guys like Tierney, Stuart Armstrong, Dembele, you know, and the market value now has rocketed. So in terms of how the teams compare, yes, Martin O'Neill had more stars, arguably Neil Lennon had a couple of more stars, but as a team unit, this is as good as probably I've seen.
Is there any sense in sort of what the expectation level is from above? Because getting through these, you know, these three qualifiers is huge, but now they're, I think they're very likely to be bottom seeds, I think, unless I think Liverpool go out tomorrow.
Liverpool, yeah.
So what's realistic now then, you know, in terms of the group stages? Because, I mean, last year's draw was a bit of a nightmare. They did okay and still didn't win a game. I mean, what's the expectation there now?
I mean, Brendan was asked this after the game tonight, and he was quite coy and basically said that if Celtic can be playing European football after Christmas, then it's progress. If you said to Celtic at the start of every single season that they would get into the Champions League group stages and they would then drop down into Europa League after Christmas, they would probably take it. Because let's be honest, Dan, I mean, Celtic aren't probably going to go any further in the last 16. They've done it three times. They've always been beaten. I think if this Celtic team went into the Europa League, if they finished third in the group stages of the Champions League and then dropped into Europa League, I think they'd have a fair crack at getting to the quarterfinals or the semi-final. So I think that would be the target for Celtic this season. If they could finish third in the group, that's a progress in last year, drop into Europa League and then have a crack. It's hard to admit that. You know, it's hard for Brendan to say, I don't particularly want to qualify or my aim isn't to qualify for the latter stages of the Champions League. But if Celtic can be playing any sort of European football after Christmas, then I think they'll have hit their target.
You talk to people in the game and Rodgers can be a divisive figure when it comes to opinions on him. You certainly hear from a large proportion of people you talk to that he is an excellent coach, and you referenced that as well, that he's worked very well with a lot of players he didn't sign, but he's improved them and the younger players have flourished under him. At the same time, there is a, I mean, the David Brent comparison gets thrown at him, and you know, in my neck of the woods growing up, somebody was called a shaper if they behaved in certain ways like Rodgers. He does have this slightly, it's harsh to use the word cheesy, or contrived maybe, it's difficult to know exactly what the word is, but there is something about his public utterances at times which leave people a bit cold more so than inspired. You spent obviously that year covering Celtic last year and working on the book. Was there a consensus amongst people? How did they find him?
No, I mean, I get that, and I do. There are some times you read Brendan's quotes and you do, and I don't know if cheesy is the right word, but you know, I get what you're saying. There are times where sometimes you know little bits, there's kind of little nuggets in there that are come out of some motivational manual or something like that, you know. But I think by and large, working quite closely with him on a daily basis and seeing him at press conferences and games and you know, and speaking on behalf of the other journalists, you know, he's been great for us. He's been absolute gold. And you ask him about anything, he's got an opinion. Sometimes some managers will say he's too opinionated because he will speak about other teams. He'll speak about certain things in football. But I don't see this sort of... I don't see that often, this Brent side and this kind of deluded Brendan Twitter account, all that sort of stuff. You know, what I see is a guy that loves to talk about football, a guy who's a very good football coach. And I think as well, you know, people talk about Brendan, where he's going to go next. I also see a guy that's really enjoying the job. You know, he's getting exposure at Celtic, he's getting back to basics, doing a lot of good coaching. And I see a guy who is probably in no rush to leave. You know, he's potentially going to be six British clubs in the Champions League this year, and he's going to be the manager of one of them. And where else could he get that in England? Is he going to go back to England to be a top four manager? Probably not right now.
Yeah.
So the experience he's getting at Celtic, the achievements, he's making a bit of history as well, getting adulation. You know, I just see a guy that's really, really enjoying his job.
And you mentioned just briefly about the opinions. I think he has been slightly critical of the other clubs in Scotland. Has that been a sort of a talking point in recent times? Maybe just explain what's been going on there.
Yeah. I mean, John Daly, you know, John Daly, who's a caretaker manager of Hearts, I'm sure the listeners will know well. John had a bit of a go at Brendan because Brendan, when defending Ian Cathro, who lost his job as a Hearts manager, a very young manager, he was only 30, basically had a go at Hearts structure, his management structure, the director of football, Craig Levein, and some even the signings, he kind of questioned the signing of Kyle Lafferty and Christophe Baer, both international players. And John Daly basically came out and called him a disgrace and said he should stick to his own team, and who does he think he is to be talking about their team and everything that's going on? He should just stick to Celtic. Even yesterday, we've not heard from Gordon Strachan since yesterday, but today's paper, Brendan's talking about Callum McGregor, Celtic midfielder, being omitted from the Scotland squad, basically saying, well, surprise, even more surprised when I saw who Gordon had picked. Now, I dare say Gordon reading that this morning won't be overly happy either, but that's Brendan. You know, he's got an opinion. John Daly's point was Brendan's the king up in Scotland and can do no wrong, and if you'd maybe, you know, step back a little bit. But, you know, I think he's just an honest guy, and to be honest with you, if he's putting noses out of joint, I don't think he's really bothered.
Yeah. Your line is just going, so we might just... No, you're fine. Maybe one last answer in the space of a minute or so, if you can. It was also noticeable that Rodgers came out and the Green Brigade, that section of Celtic fans, were being criticised and fined for political banners. And yeah, Rodgers came out, and I thought quite skillfully in his press conference, extended olive branches to them, but also said to leave the politics behind. He seemed to handle that situation with the Green Brigade very well.
Yeah, I mean, he's, in terms of his public speaking and as an ambassador for Celtic, he's been very good. And it was a bit of a difficult situation for him because he was put into something and brought into something that he's never really been involved with growing up in Northern Ireland. He'd always shied away from even having an opinion and anything like that. And it was a bit unfortunate for Brendan, but you're right, you know, he had to be careful what he said, in the sense that this Green Brigade section have got quite a lot of power at Celtic, but I think they took it on board, and his point was, leave all the politics at the door, you know, let's stick to the football. And, you know, I think they've heeded the warning. I think Brendan has got such a status at Celtic and such power at Celtic that he's one of the few managers probably that could come out and give them a kind of slight slap in the wrist and move on with it. But I think that's all over with now. The Green Brigade are back in at Celtic. The display last week against Astana in the first leg was about Conor McGregor in the UFC, I think they've moved on from the other stuff now.
Yeah. David Friel of the Scottish Sun, author as well of Invincible, Brendan Rodgers' historic first season at Celtic. Thanks very much, David.
No problem, guys. Thanks.
Cheers. David Friel there on the line. Earlier on, we asked you to name the stadium where Galway play their home Inverkenny games. The answer is Pearse Stadium. Congratulations to Michael Moylan. You won a pair of tickets, Michael, to our Off the Ball Roadshow end of the month. That's the Off the Ball Roadshow live from Galway, 31st of August, thanks to Bord Gáis Energy, hashtag hurling to the core. Pretty much just done for this evening. Any final thoughts on all that?
No, I mean, we'll see. The draw for Celtic could be cruel. They could get like Madrid, PSG and Spurs or something, you know, so that it's difficult for them to be in that pot four potentially. You know, where is the ceiling for where they can go? I might have written about this for tomorrow's paper, Joe. So shameless plugging there.
The Irish Independent, who'd miss it?
Who'd miss it, exactly.
We're pretty much done. Busy show for you tomorrow. Tom Dunn is on the way next, and we'll see you at the usual time tomorrow, 7 o'clock. Good luck.
Off the Ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.